A large crowd had gathered outside of Kilmainham, with heads all uncovered, they knelt on the ground. Far behind that grim prison lay a brave Irish soldier, his life for his country about to lay down. He went to his death like a true son of Ireland. The firing party he bravely did face. Then the order rang out, present arms and fire. James Connolly fell into a ready-made grave. The black flag was hoisted.
Formal house here. It's very informal here at East as a Podcast. Welcome to the show, Chris. Thank you for doing this. I read your wonderful article on liberated texts, and I said to Louis, I said, you know, we got to do something. I got to have him on the show. So welcome, welcome, welcome. What are we here to talk about? This is a seminar with Professor Bosang. Tell us what we're learning from today. This is my favorite kind of episode. And it's not, I mean, I know that's self-interested because I have to do the least amount of work for a show like this, where I just like sit back and kick up my feet and the other person does all the work. I get to learn the most. It's like I get my own basically like private tutor in an episode like this. So everybody's excited. Well, I'm excited.
I'm happy to fulfill the service. Thanks so much for having me on.
My name is Chris. I am a writer. I've got a novel coming out next year, I hope. And I write...
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. I'm very excited about it. I'm going to... And write... Yeah, and I have... I write about literary history in general and about Marxism and about the national question, mostly in an Irish context. I'm delighted to be here to talk about James Connolly and the Irish independence struggle, the struggle for national self-determination and socialism. So that's how that Louis thing came about. I wrote a review of a book by two guys named Bill Rolston and Robbie McVeigh. And I think that caught your eye, and that's how you heard about it, yeah?
I've had a couple of shows about Ireland about now, but I haven't done a deep, deep dive into Irish history, really. And I mean, I mentioned this in the previous shows. I did a little bit of my dissertation on Ireland, at least sort of on an Anglo-Irish writer and this institution in Dublin. But really, my appreciation of like Irish history ends really in like 1801 or like 1802. Like I kind of very quickly left. And so I do find it like really useful for an episode like this, just to provide a preamble that like the scale of the imperial conflict over Ireland, like the scale of the violence, the centuries of violence. And that's the sort of great thing you lay out in your article, of just kind of like listing it out in very chronological and kind of like simple, like layman's terms, the nature of this colonial monster that has basically been like attached to Ireland for five centuries more now. So like that is like a, you know, I think people, I definitely don't appreciate the depth of that. Like I did it after I read your article, obviously, but maybe at the outset we can kind of, you know, give us a sense of, you know, looking at it broadly, the Irish experience of British colonization, I think it's fair to say is like, they are the most intimate, one of the most intimate of victims, I guess you could call it, of British imperialism. I mean, that's an obvious term, but like, I hate to use that term just solely, but in the sense of as a direct object of colonization, like Ireland has been with this thing, this monster called the British Empire since the beginning, right? Like this so-called laboratory for empire, right? So maybe kind of begin at the beginning, if you want, and do a student in your article. We can kind of take it from there.
Okay, so I guess the colonization of Ireland proper kind of begins with Poyning's Law in 1494, which gives the English crown claims on the Irish kingdom.
Ireland wouldn't have been a unified kingdom. I don't think at any stage you would have had a single high king that had total control over the island. There was just kind of competing tribes. And this rule was kind of consolidated only with the plantations of the 16th and 17th centuries. Up until that point, you had maybe an administrative centre in Dublin and a few other settlements along the east coast. But in no sense would they have had hegemony out into the countryside, and especially not up into the north in Ulster. Up until the 16th, 17th centuries, that would have been the case. But then you get these plantations during which English planters are granted lands, primarily in southern and eastern parts of the country. These ventures initially fail. They don't do very well, both due to administrative incompetence. They just kind of give people grants and send them over, and also native resistance from the very outset when the English begin imposing these new social relations onto Irish feudalism and break down the kind of collective or communal social structures that prevailed before. There's resistance. There's an anti-imperialist sentiment. There's a get these guys out of here kind of thing. So,
is this, sorry to interrupt you, is this the first settler colonialism of the whatever you want to call it, British Empire, English Empire? Is this the inception?
Yeah, I think you could definitely, when the 1641 uprising happens, which is a point at which you get this, Hugh O'Neill is a guy from up north who begins planning these sorts of invasions of British garrisons and to take them over and to seize the weapons. This act prompts, as is generally the case with these things, the countryside to suddenly rise up, and you get a lot of attacks on Protestant settlers in areas across the country. And this uprising, which is framed in the English press in terms of the Papists, the Catholics, the uncivilized Irish people are rising up to crush the civilized Protestants, you can say that English identity kind of takes shape here for the first time, when they understand themselves as being not Irish or not Scottish and not Welsh, but this kind of kind of a manifest destiny sense you can kind of see in some of the evangelical sentiment around the figure like Oliver Cromwell. Does that kind of answer your question a little bit?
Yeah. I mean, these are the first Brits, I'm tempted to say, the idea of Britishness is a fundamentally imperial idea, right? Like, that's the thing. It's a relationship to other people mediated through an identity. I mean, I'm really out here arguing. I mean, there are way more trained people to think this, but like, that's the only way I can think of a Britishness ultimately. And it's stitched through the violence done to its direct neighbors.
Yeah, totally. And like, there's this sentiment you'll encounter occasionally from people who are English, who talk about the Englishness as outside of the Union. But the reality is there never was an Englishness outside of that Union. It was always totally, totally integral to that ideology of expansion and of conquest and of social engineering, you know.
Right. Okay. Sorry, I interrupted you. Keep going.
No, not at all. So Cromwell kills an awful lot of people. There's kind of mass slaughter across the country, particularly at the Siege of Drogheda, which actually shocked world opinion at a time when you might imagine the kind of, extreme acts of violence on a scale would be kind of more or less commonplace. But Cromwell grants poor quality land to Catholics who could demonstrate definitively that they had no part in the 1641 rebellion. He gives them land in the western parts of the country, kind of where stony and fertile soil were. And he also takes many prisoners who are sent as settlers or workers to the American or to Americas or the Caribbean. So there's this widespread project of dispossession and of killing that the Lord Protector Cromwell kind of brings over. After that, so the plantations then kind of begin underway in a more concentrated manner. They kind of ensure that these places that were centers of dissent and anti-British resistance, like up in Ulster, are, they won't be doing that again in the future. They make sure that tenants are brought over from Scotland. They make sure that, they provide assistance on the basis of, okay, they're not hiring any locals, they're bringing people over in order to kind of keep that process of dispossession ongoing, right? And every instance in which there is challenge to that rule, then the British have this occasion to introduce even more draconian measures. You have the introduction of the penal laws, which are brought in towards the end of the 17th century, which prevented Catholics from obtaining positions in the state bureaucracy, the professions. They couldn't handle firearms, intermarriages were outlawed, and any orphan had to be parented by a Protestant. And you can kind of maybe see some parallels there with imperialism later on, or Christopher Columbus almost coterminously, where, you know, native peoples were segregated and separated and put into
institutions. It's the birth of apartheid.
It is, absolutely. There's an apartheid structure put in these plantations, and that's deliberate, and that's something that's planned from the outright. Yeah,
it really was the laboratory of empire. It really, I mean, I know this is an abused term, and I think it's obviously more complicated because, like, I'm sure Scottish people have a sentiment too here to add, but like, it does feel in some ways so like that, like Ireland became the backdrop of like the Bildungsroman of like the British violence machine that they would then go out into the world. And I mean, what's crazy too, I mean, we can get into this, but that then they would conscript like the story of the British Empire too, obviously, is that like they conscript members of that society to then go and replicate that work and be part of it. So like the Irish get conscripted either literally or figuratively in the sense of economically and displaced and whatever. I mean, Connolly himself speaks with a Scottish accent. My dog is going nuts, which is like the craziest fact in the world. Like the great Irish revolutionary speaks English with a Scottish accent. Anyways, this is the place I want to get to, but let's keep.
Okay, well, we're nearly there. We're nearly at Connolly. So Ireland is contained then within the Act of Union, which is passed in 1801. This afforded some expansion of the vote to Irish men who owned or rented property, which was worth more than 40 shillings. And Ireland is, of course, unique in the sense that, you know, this is not a privilege, if you like, that's extended to many of the other peoples contained within the British Empire. And you begin to get some kind of a maybe garrison or settler colonial orientation among some sections of the Irish independence movement, you know, however broadly you want to define that. Figures such as Daniel O'Connell and you know, later on, Isaac Butter, Arthur Griffiths, to get ahead a bit. So they begin to sort of identify with the British Empire and kind of just want to carve out a section of its dividends for Ireland, you know, maybe even regarded as part of an imperial project. There are people who are talking about getting slave trading companies kind of based in Belfast and Galway. And that might kind of bring us on to kind of what Connolly's broader political project was, which is to point out that if you have a bourgeoisie that wants to fight for national independence and then claim it solely on bourgeois terms, you know, you won't be getting anywhere. That won't be a liberationist project as such.
I'm looking around me, I spied a boat tinker who only by chance came a stroll in the same way. The weather being fine, sure, he sat down beside her. What news, honest man, this old woman did say. That's no news at all, ma'am, replied the bold tinker. But the people will wish that he never had been. It's that damnable rogue of a Daniel O'Connell. He's now making children in Dublin be steamed.
Okay, so Daniel O'Connell is a barrister, and he's kind of from quite a staunchly middle class background. And when the Brits passed the 1801 Act of Union, which kind of abrogates the sovereignty of the Irish Parliament, and also serves to erode the basis on which Irish industry rests, there was a relatively thriving woolen trade in Ireland, for example, which, you know, as any listener to the show would know. The imperial power, it's important for them to ensure that the subject peoples are sort of, their industries are underdeveloped and they don't have the capacity to perhaps compete with that of the with the industries in the metropole. So people like Daniel O'Connell and indeed also the peasantry and what kind of craftsmen, occasional labor that their population that there would have been, are recruited into this mass movement in order to call for the repeal of the union. To kind of, because I didn't actually prepare a huge amount of notes to talk about Daniel O'Connell's political career because I thought it might be a bit too big, but I can skip ahead a bit and say there were people within that movement who became kind of frustrated with O'Connell's kind of obdurate commitment to, you know, not a hugely radical program and kind of principled pacifism and things like that, particularly during the famine, when obviously you were getting millions of Irish people starving, emigrating, while grain was being exported to feed the English working class. You know, Ireland was exporting calories that would have fed its entire population many, many times over in the mid-19th century when the famine is kind of ripping through the population. And these more radical characters within Daniel O'Connell's movement, the Young Irelanders, such as Jim Mitchell and a couple of other names are fucking escaping me now. But Connolly talks about them in his book, Labour and Irish History. He points out that the Young Irelander movement were, they had the right idea. They were calling for rent strikes and they were going to the peasantry and telling them that they needed to resist. But ultimately, they didn't have a fully thought out theory or idea of what their leadership should be. And ultimately, their capacity to mobilize the peasantry, you know, didn't work. And people like O'Connell remain within the pantheon of these great Irish patriots who brought an end to the penal laws and laid the foundation for independence to come, but ultimately were not on the side of the men with no property. And Connolly identifies Wolfe Tone as being, and the United Irishman as being the exception.
The internally displaced people of the great hunger, the famine, that was basically
totally.
His parents, right?
I guess part of the, you might have a bit more information on me than on that than I do. I don't know a huge amount about their parents other than they kind of trace their roots back to Monaghan. But absolutely, like, his parents move over to Scotland. He's of Irish descent, but he would have been part of this enormous diaspora of Irish people going both to England, to Scotland, to the United States. Absolutely, yeah.
Well, if Henry Grattan was the father of the Irish constitutional nationalist tradition in the 18th century, then the father of the revolutionary tradition was another Trinity graduate, a man called Theobald Wolfe Tone. And Wolfe Tone is seen as the father of modern Irish republicanism. He is, I suppose, the inspiration for so many of the revolutionary figures who followed in his footsteps. Even though, in a sense, he didn't come out with anything radically new in the late 18th century, it was more that, I suppose, he channeled a lot of the ideas that were going around, ideas inspired by the American Revolution and then by the French Revolution, and he gave them practical expression. He also did it in his brilliant writings. He was one of the most readable of the Irish writers of the 18th century. You could read him today and think it had just been written yesterday. It had such immediacy about it. It was written in such a vibrant and brilliant style. And in a way, he helped popularise a lot of ideas. Crucially, ideas about why Ireland should be an independent, separate country, and also ideas about why the Catholics could be trusted. Because up until then, there were all of these divisions between Catholics, Protestants and dissenters. The dissenters were the Presbyterians, all at each other's throats. And Tone looked at what had happened in France, and he, in this great publication called An Argument on Behalf of the Catholics in Ireland, published in 1791, which became the great bestseller of the 1790s in Ireland, he argued that in Ireland we should substitute the name of Catholic, Protestant and Dissenter for the common united name of Irishman. And he helped form an organisation, gave them a name, the United Irishmen, that would really put aside all of these religious distinctions and that they would work together as Irishmen and work to create an Irish Republic. And this idea of Irish republicanism was different from what Grattan and the others were talking about. This was a rejection of the notion of an Irish Parliament that was still linked to the British Crown, still part of the British Empire. This was talking about separatism. And Wolfe Tone later claimed that he had been a separatist all his life. Well, that wasn't true. Certainly in 1781, he had wanted to leave college, to leave Trinity, to go off and join the British Army and fight against the American colonists. His mother didn't give him permission. She didn't allow him. And so he was forced to carry on. In 1788, he wrote to the British Prime Minister, William Pitt, asking to be put in charge of a military colony in the South Sea Islands in what is now Hawaii. And that as in command of this garrison, he would actually launch attacks on Spanish ships bringing treasure from South America. So in the 1780s, Wolfetone was a man looking for a role in life, looking for adventure. But influenced by what was going on around him, he became a revolutionary, a republican, a separatist, and he became then the inspiration for so much of the radical activity of the 1790s.
Yeah, I mean, so like part of the sort of global Irish story is something that's shared by a lot of colonized people, especially people who are colonized by the British, which is upheaval and violence done to your own society, to your own social makeup, and which results in emigration and circulation between the other places that, you know, the British Empire needed bodies, they needed labor. And it's like such a, you know, Connolly's story, from like the little that I know about him, is such like a, it's like an allegory for the nation. Like, it's such a national story of this experience of the Irish 19th century, of the dislocation from his, of like his roots, and like the uprooting of like all these, the civilization essentially, right? Like, that's whatever, like whatever Cromwell and them didn't do was then uprooted in the 19th century. And so it's like mind-boggling to think of like how much this guy represented the story of his people, in like how national he was, if we can talk like that.
Yeah, 100%. There's a great bit in the foreword to kind of what was his primary theoretical and historical work called Labour in Irish History, where he talks about, in a way that almost anticipates, you know, you were talking about the broader history of dispossessed and colonized peoples, the work of Frantz Fanon, right? Where he's talking about what colonization does on an ideological or an individual level to a subject peoples, where it undermines their level of cultural development, their kind of self-esteem or consciousness of themselves as kind of an historical force, in the same way that, you know, the working class in the metropole might, you know, by contrast. Yeah, for sure. Connolly was born in 1868 in Edinburgh in Scotland, and he was very much, we'll emphasize from the bat, at the lowest possible stage in the social ladder you can get. His father's job was literally to shovel horseshit off the streets, so you can't get much lower than that, I think. He had to leave family at a very early age in order to earn money from the family, so his first job was working in a printer's. A factory inspector showed up and noticed that he was too young to be working there, and he had to go and work in a bakery after that. I know we just said we'd go to biography, but I guess I have to give a little bit of context from the famine into what he would have become aware of when he was working in the print shop. So after Ungerda Moor, the famine, the British would have come in, and or British speculators and landlords would have come in and picked up a lot of the land that would have previously been held by small tenant farmers, the ones who were dispossessed even after that.
It's so fucked to think like that. Just come and feast on the carcass of like the dead
totally.
Society, no, and like, just destroyed.
I only heard this recently, right? So just to kind of double back on a point I half made earlier. Obviously, your listeners will be aware of the potato famine. What's important to underline, like, it wasn't just this fungus. This wasn't just a natural catastrophe that just spread through the nation just because, like, this was a consequence of social relations that the Brits were imposing and the free trade capitalist framework that the island had to live under. And they were so ruthlessly committed to this idea of not interfering in this, you know, natural process. The relief works that they would set up consisted of building improvements, quote unquote, on the land. But these improvements couldn't actually improve the agricultural output. They had to be useless, and they had to be on land that nobody could conceivably benefit from. Like, that's the level of non-intervention. So there are some places in remote parts of the country, actually there was one near me in the university I was going to there a few years ago, there's just this neoclassical facade in the middle of nowhere that's just this famine work that, you know, starving peasants would just be tasked with constructing, and that was supposed to be some form of relief.
It's like something out of a Simpsons episode, like you know, when they show what like a medieval serfdom is. It's like turning a mill, like that's really what the English did to you people, like just like that kind of subjugation. And it was like, I, you know, to the degree of, you know, to the caloric, managing the number of calories that Irish people were consuming. I mean, it's just, I'm gonna keep saying this again and again. The scale of the violence subjected to you, like, just by these people who are like across the fucking river. Like, that's like,
yeah, I don't know why I'm laughing in response, but yeah, it is deeply fucked, and it's really almost I don't know what other kind of reaction. If you don't laugh, you'll cry. Do you know what I mean? So they've acquired about 5 million additional acres, about a quarter of the land on the island. These landlords, as you can imagine, were not very good. They were often absentees. They didn't invest in their holdings. They weren't very interested in, you know, improving the output. So tenant farmers often rented this land at extremely onerous rates in addition to everything. So in 1879, an Irish Republican named Michael Davitt founds the Land League during a general agricultural depression in which tenant farmers are having problems paying their rent. This league was set up, at first in order to set up a collective structure within which tenant farmers who were under pressure could fight back against particular landlords. So withhold their rent, boycotts, right? You would, the landlords would find themselves unable to conduct business with other people. Tenants wouldn't go on their land, all these sorts of things. And the Land League then becomes this broader social program calling for something called the 3 F's, which is fair rent, self-explanatory, fixity of tenure, so that's protection against evictions, and freedom of sale for tenant farmers, so they could sell up if they wanted to, and be compensated for any improvements that they carried out themselves. This was also taking place alongside land agitation, which has a long history in Ireland, where there would be attacks on landlords, their livestock, houses would get burnt down, and things like that. That would have been going on forever back in Irish history as long as there were British landlords. And there's also this change on the parliamentary front. I said that Ireland was sort of unique in being able to send MPs to the British Parliament in Westminster. And initially Fenians, who were the Irish Republican Brotherhood, you know, the IRB, the forerunners of the IRA, who more listeners might be familiar with, as well as the Fenian Brotherhood, which is based in the United States. These are both clandestine organizations. They had a history of unsuccessful risings throughout the 19th century, and they had also waged incendiary bombing campaigns in London once or twice. So these guys had historically abstained from Westminster, but towards the end of the 19th century, they begin to try a different tack, and they take their seats and adopt this strategy called obstructionism, where they would filibuster for hours and hours and hold up the business of the house. Charles Stuart Parnell, an Anglo-Irish landlord from Wicklow, which is a county just south of Dublin, was one of these obstructionists and became leader of the Irish Parliamentary Party. So in the figure of Parnell, and I won't go too deeply into his political career, you had the coming together of this parliamentary home rule movement and the more revolutionary aspects of the Irish independence movement coming together. Now, in 1891, he was deposed as the Irish Parliamentary Party's leader. Parnell was when more liberal elements within the home rule movement and the Catholic Church took against him, after he was found to be in a relationship with a married woman, and he died very shortly after. I'm sorry,
Can we talk about home rule as a concept?
Absolutely, yeah. What do you want to know?
Because it is also a uniquely Irish conception too, right? Because of, again, the strange privilege, the strange relationship of being one of the most closely colonized, it's like a weird, I don't know, is the relationship between metropole and colony in the Irish context like historically unique? I mean, I guess every country is, but like, is there any kind of analogy that you can think of that could be made equivalent? Like, because home rule is also like a reaction to that unique relationship too, right? Like, it's an attempt to correct for, because it's not like a separatist movement, right? Like, that's all gone by this time.
Absolutely, and home rule is kind of a more conciliationist. At various points, it kind of starts to resemble more closely almost a devolution of powers, or the sort of executive office that you'd expect in maybe local government, like power of changing tax rates and stuff like that. It's not anything significant. It doesn't give you ownership over the ports, doesn't give you ownership over natural resources, as to whether it's historically, you know, unprecedented and not replicated anywhere. Like, someone smarter than me listening to this would probably know the answer to the question. I'm just a national question expert in an Irish context. But
my follow-up would be, like, is the Irish history following a de-radicalization over the course of the 19th century, like, and throughout the 20th century kind of too, with a notable with a notable blip.
Yeah, it's
because the United Irishmen of the 1819 of like the 1790s are very, very radical compared to even the IRA of like 200 years later.
Yeah, it's an interesting. I mean, you can't really understate the extent of the demoralization, you know, engendered by something like the famine. Like if you would look at that and think, well, if there's going to be some kind of a mass movement there, it's definitely gonna happen around this genocide, call it what it is, but it doesn't. And the countryside and the island itself, you know, the population still hasn't recovered to the pre-famine levels, which is just.
But also too, it wasn't just the famine, because the story of 19th century Ireland too is also the story of emigration, the moving around, the creation, like the violent manufacture of an Irish diaspora that goes from, you know, North America, you know, to India, to all over. Like this is not, and in different shapes too, right? Like there's also like the Irish people who are part of the British military, of like the British imperial machine directly. And then there's the settler part. And then there's like, you know, so this is like a mosaic of all this different kind of history of imperialism played out on these like not very populous amount of people. I mean, Ireland is never a huge place to begin with.
Yeah, for sure. And it kind of it speaks to what you're saying there about the conciliationist nature, to bring it back to the what happened to the kind of the Home Rule movement after the Irish Parliamentary Party, where this very staunchly middle class guy, John Redmond, who kind of runs the party as it moves in this far more conciliationist direction, is all the time paying lip service to Irish revolutionaries such as Wolfe Tone, while not reflecting their primary commitments, which were liberty, equality, fraternity, breaking the connection of England via the men of no property. And Redmond is all the time able to present himself to that diaspora as the proper inheritor of that independence struggle, while people like Connolly, whose life work is kind of devoted to telling those people, no, you know, stop sending him money, send my party subscriptions, we're actually fighting for your interests. His whole life is devoted to pointing out, like, you know, John Redmond and the people in his political party are slum landlords. You know, they're not allies of the working class or of Irish independence either.
An actual working class hero, an actual like living working class hero, James Connolly.
It really can't be understated just how completely he fits that mold. Do you know what I mean? I mean, I'm sure you've just, even from the little
like
you've
prototypical.
Read, you can see. Oh, totally.
Yeah, like all the characters, literally, and he ended up doing the job as an adult that his dad did when he was a kid. Like the violence of class, like that class violence of staying poor and remaining poor, like the guy saw in real life, he experienced it. And he also experienced emigration and return and all that stuff. I mean, just this guy is in some ways like an embodiment of Irish history. Like there's so few figures like this. I mean, I this is a total divergence, but I was thinking today, I was like, you know, they sold Obama as not working class hero, but a hero of the people. But that's like not the same thing. There's a very subtle thing that happens in the US that like, but he's just like this like middle, like, you know, upper class dude connected to the US deep state, like through his mom. And like that's it. He was just another George Bush, but from a different part and a different sector of society. Whereas like, actual guys like James Connolly are forged from history, if you could like be corny like that. Like literally in the shit of like Victorian capitalism, this guy rises to like challenge, to like seriously threaten British imperial order that had been basically running unopposed in this country.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't you know, I don't know if like better than Obama is like a great necessary takeaway than for in presenting the life of James Connolly, but like,
but, I mean, in the sense of like how people sell, like, because people had real feelings for Obama. I remember like Americans, like I was living in the US when it happened, people were genuinely enthralled by this guy, and like to the point where like, you know, I mean, that's. And it worked, like the media, the marketing, the hype, it all worked, you know, to the, you know, and that there's a complicated story under that because of the violence experienced by like the African-American, like underclass of society, of US society, which is the sort of subtle but always present person who was always speaking with Obama, you know, like that figure of like bourgeois progress, right? Like that's a very middle class idea that history moves forward and people get better. But like James Connolly knew that like history moves forward, sure, but conditions get worse. And like that's where like the Marxist experience and like it's the class character thing, I guess. Because like working class people do the same thing, like working class like activists and whatever organizers, if you can call that, they do the same thing that middle class people do. But ultimately, whose interests do you represent? Like Obama obviously represents the interests of the capitalists and the bosses, obviously, whereas James Connolly came from below. I don't know why I'm comparing Obama to him, but it's just we have so few political leaders in our part of the world who inspire anything. You know, so it's like, other than Trump, who's a reactionary, he just inspired racism. So I don't count that. But like actual, like positive political feeling.
It's looking back to this period of time, just in the couple of decades before the war, and then maybe in the couple of decades afterwards. But then again, in the post-war period, into the 60s, into the 70s, the Tricontinental Non-Aligned Movement, it seems like we're in a real dearth stage. I mean, you know, just speaking from my own part of the world, which I'm most familiar with, you know, these kind of people who come from the underclass are organic intellectuals and are ruthless agitators, strategic geniuses. Yeah, they really killed them all. They really wiped that whole slate clean. Hopefully that'll change soon. But yeah.
Let us free Ireland. Never mind such base, carnal thoughts as concern work and wages, healthy homes, our lives unclouded by poverty. Let us free Ireland. The rack renting landlord, is he not also an Irishman? And wherefore should we hate him? Nay, let us not speak harshly of our brother, yea, even when he raises our rent. Let us free Ireland. The profit-grinding capitalist who robs us of three-fourths of the fruits of our labour, who sucks the very marrow of our bones when we were young, and then throws us out on the street like a worn-out tool when we are grown prematurely old in his service. Is he not an Irishman? And mayhap a patriot? And wherefore should we think harshly of him? Let us free Ireland. The land that bred and bore us, and the landlord who makes us pay for permission to live upon it. Whoop it up for liberty. Let us free Ireland, says the patriot, who won't touch socialism. Let us all join together and crush the brutal Saxon. Let us all join together, says he, all classes and creeds, and says the town worker, after we have crushed the Saxon and freed Ireland. What will we do now? Oh, then you can go back to your slums, same as before. Whoop it up for liberty. And says the agricultural workers, after we have freed Ireland. What then? Oh, then you can go scraping around for landlord's rent or the money lender's interest, same as before. Whoop it up for liberty. After Ireland is free, says the patriot, who won't touch socialism, we will protect all classes, and if you won't pay your rent, you will be evicted, same as now. But the evicting party, under command of the sheriff, will wear green uniforms, and the hat without the crown, and the warrant turning you out on the roadside will be stamped with the arms of the Irish Republic. Now, isn't that worth fighting for? And when you cannot find employment, and giving up the struggle of a life in despair, enter the poorhouse, the band of the nearest regiment of the Irish Army. They will escort you to the poorhouse, to the tune of St. Patrick's Day. Oh, it will be nice to live in those days, with the green flag floating over us and an ever-increasing army of unemployed workers walking around under the green flag, wishing they had something to eat. Same as now.
whoop it up for liberty. Therefore, I say, let us organize as a class to meet our masters and destroy their mastership. Organize to drive them from their hold upon public life through their political power. Organize to wrench from their rubber clutch the land and the workshops on and in which they enslave us. Organize to cleanse our social life from the stain of social cannibalism, from the preying of man upon his fellow man. Organize for a full, free, and happy life. For all or for none. Conor.
Okay, I interrupted you. Let's keep going. Okay. Where were we?
So Connolly, as you were saying, as him being kind of an archetypal Irishman and representing the essential Irish experience, he falsifies his age in order to follow his older brother into the British Army. He's stationed...
It's so fucked.
He's stationed in the Curra, which is in Kildare. We don't know. He was stationed somewhere else, and we don't know where exactly. But we do know that he told his daughter, Nora, that he hated it, and the barracks were like, you know, the lowest form of life as far as he was concerned. He deserted very, very quickly, relatively quickly, and he followed his brother again back to Scotland, where he begins to get involved with the labour movement. And it's here that he meets all the people who are important to him in shaping his politics, his capacity to speak, his rhetoric, his thinking, and his Marxism as well. You had people like Karl Marx's daughter, Eleanor, James Keir Hardie and John Leslie around, and Connolly stood for election for one of the most important Marxist parties then on the scene, the Scottish Socialist Federation. He didn't do very well, but he did meet his wife, Lily Reynolds, in Dublin at one stage because he was going back and forth, and he stayed with her his whole life. I'm kind of skipping ahead then a bit, not necessarily in response to a question, but you can shut me up or tell me that I have to stop if you want. He then goes back to Dublin. You know, I mentioned that he met his wife, but he's kind of going back and forth between Scotland, the United States, and Dublin, and Belfast later. And he, in Dublin this time, he founds the Irish Socialist Republican Party, the ISRP. I always get that confused because someone else did the IRSP later on. But anyway, Connolly's founds the ISRP, and he begins to organize. He receives a full-time wage as an organizer, and he starts trying to organize workers in Dublin. One of the biggest challenges he faced here was that the labor movement in Ireland was kind of at a historical peak when Marx was still alive, and he was giving the proper weight to the national question in Irish affairs. He supported the Fenians in all of his writings. There's a story about him telling, or Eleanor Marx identifying from a young age as a Fenian, which is funny, but by the stage the Connolly's coming along, the trade union movement has become a lot more provincial, and it's more or less exclusively interested in economistic gains. The leadership is quite quiescent, and of course, you know, the working class in Dublin are very, very Catholic, and the Marxism and socialism, the priests are always very quick to denounce it as an atheistic or a foreign doctrine. So Connolly begins this kind of process of meticulously researching Irish history and publishing the writings of people like Wolfe Tone, radical members of the Young Ireland movement, like John Mitchell, James Fintan Lehler, Wolfe Tone. James Fintan Lehler actually anticipated many aspects of Marx's critique of capitalism and of political economy. I think that's all I wanted to say about him coming back to Dublin at that time. Oh, there is one more thing, sorry. Some of the practical obstacles he faced were that Irish capitalism was, of course, constantly in competition with the British. So, you know, Irish workers would be seasonal, they'd be occasional. You'd get migrants coming in from the countryside when there'd be a bad harvest or there was a depression. There was a guild system for skilled workers still in place. So it was really difficult to get the working class, these different sections of the working class, they were kind of striated to recognize that they had a common interest in coming together. Final thing before I let you ask me another question was, you know, he had Republican in the name of the organization for a reason. He always identified the national liberation struggle and the struggle for socialism as being one and the same thing. And this is a very famous quote from him that everyone will know, but I'll read it anyway because it's never lost its relevance. If you remove the English army tomorrow and hoist the green flag over Dublin Castle, unless you sweat about the organization of the Socialist Republic, your efforts will be in vain. England will still rule you through her capitalists, through her landlords, through her financiers, through the whole array of commercial and individualist institutions she has planted in this country and watered with the tears of our mothers and the blood of our martyrs.
My God, that's amazing.
His writing is
no
just...
No one writes like this anymore. Yeah. Like
no one writes
this,
like this.
This writing is gone.
Totally. And like... There are levels of moral indignation you get in stuff like Marx or Engels in between all the really, really dry or Hegelian kind of stuff. But Connolly just gets into the moral indignation with the scientific critique and does both at once. Did you read much of his stuff? It's absolutely masterful the way he goes about this. Just pick a random page.
No, I want
anywhere.
To dive into it more. Yeah. It's really like florid prose. I mean, you do literary history, so you know this. It's like the contribution of Ireland alone, like Ireland to just in the literary realm is so staggering. Like the way that like Irish people took the English language, made it their own, and then proceeded to become some of the most like important writers in the canonical traditions of that language is another mind-boggling fact of the colonization of Ireland. Like just, and I mean, I guess one thing I did want to ask you is that by the time like the 20th century rolls around, I guess this is related to my previous question about like, is it getting less radical over the years? And part of what always wonders in my mind is that like throughout the 19th century and before that too, Irish people, like people from Ireland are voluntarily or not so voluntarily just hopping on the empire train, right? Like going wherever is needed. Like, do you ever wonder that like that operated as a kind of like a valve, like a kind of pressure valve for like the powers that be, in the sense that like, because you can kind of just, this is like the problem in the British novel, right? Like how do you solve the problem in a Victorian novel is marriage or emigration. And so like, this is I always wonder too, if that like, this is one of the reasons why Marxism fails, like in all of its big tests across the European continent, beginning in the mid 19th century, while Marx and Engels are still alive, and then throughout, like, is it because that they had thrown in their lot with the imperialists long ago, and as a class hadn't really stood up against the imperialists? Now, could a 19th century Irish working class person stand up to a British imperialist doing violence in India? No. Did they have like the ability to, or like, I don't know, probably not. Like, did they have any interest? I don't know. But I just feel that like there's something karmic about like being subject to more imperialism over the course of time, partly and as you are also helping that project in other countries. Like Irish people helped colonization of the US. They helped colonization of Canada. They helped colonization like across the world. Like they were enforcers across India, courses across like parts, like, you know, that's part of the Irish diasporic too, is that like other people, they were then brought into this machine of violence. I mean, Indian people too also fought in World War I, you know, so like this is a global story too. But I wonder if there's any kind of if you have any kind of response or like a feeling around that of like, class solidarity went out the window long before the 20th century in Europe, and Ireland is included in that because ultimately, like, that the participation in the imperial project kind of precludes working class solidarity across the world. It just means that no working class, like the class solidarity with the people who are white.
Yeah. Okay. So there's an enormous amount of material there, I think. I'm going to try to hit all of those. So is the question as to whether the Irish stand up? So in the Connolly, in his book Labour and Irish History, Connolly is trying to basically do what Marx does to world history in the Communist Manifesto, and to demonstrate that the history, you know, the history of Ireland is the history of class struggle, and that they have been, and that the Irish independence struggle, the struggle for social equality, has been continually has continually failed and been let down, has been continually let down by its leaders, you know, sold out by them, and also through failures of leadership and, of course, you know, British defeat. Did the Young Irelander movement, which I keep coming back to, might have had the idea, but didn't have the capacity to lead. Similarly, Wolfe Tone, the United Irishman, was kind of undone by informers and by a kind of a sporadic military effort. There is resistance, and there are clandestine military organizations like the Fenians who are devoted to those sorts of things, but they do remain sporadic, for the reason that, for the same thing that we see in every colonial context, the working class gets divided and is almost prevented from becoming this historical force that it is in Britain, Germany, France, you know, for better or worse. As to the question as to whether the Irish have a case to answer as regards to empire, I mean, I probably spend almost every day of my life kind of thinking about this. If that doesn't sound kind of sad or insane, but the contradiction that exists between Irish nationality as tending towards kind of Connolly's values or Wolfe Tone's, the unity of Protestant, Catholic and the centre, versus that kind of atavistic foot soldiers of empire thing is present the whole way along the line. And I haven't read enough to kind of marshal it all together within a single hypothesis or thesis statement, if you like. Rolston and McVeigh, in their book, make the point that the officers of the British Empire were overwhelmingly English, and that the Irish were kind of, you know, lower level corporals. I'm not saying that exonerates them or gets us away from any kind of discussion of culpability, but that even those Irish figures that would have attained some superiority were large Anglo-Irish landlords. But even though that probably would have been known and widespread, it's still, the Irish independence struggle still provokes acts of solidarity from oppressed peoples in other places. The Irish independence struggle, the Indian independence struggle takes kind of inspiration from Ireland. You know, Gandhi, controversial figure, looks to De Valera's constitution as a model. In the US, when slaves are freed, there's this incredible speech that I don't have in front of me that Rolston and McVeigh produce about how they would send fighters over once they had been freed in order to fight on behalf of the Fenians against the British. Marcus Garvey named his headquarters in New York Liberty Hall in reference to James Connolly. And just a final example, at a mass meeting in that Charles Stuart Parnell had held in Navan, which is a town in Meath, I think. Everyone's going to be screaming at me if I'm wrong. In 1879, 30,000 Irish people chant the name of the Zulu King Cetshwayo, who was at that point waging a war of resistance against the British. So, I mean, it's a complicated picture, and I really wish we weren't foot soldiers in these other places.
Yeah, it's the contradiction. It's like the structuring contradiction of Irish history.
Oh, that was the one thing. That was the one thing I actually didn't hit. Sorry, on the question of like European solidarity. Yeah, I mean, the International just completely fucks things in the lead up to the war. You get this, the grip of people like Rosa Luxemburg, who say that the struggle for national liberation is a distraction from the real revolution, and that, you know, Connolly, the Bolsheviks, and the Serbian social democracy are unique in recognizing that, no, you need to weaken imperialism. You have to turn the World War One into a civil war against the capitalists. Yeah, that's another tragedy of this period.
All of Connolly's instincts were right. He had really good political instincts once he kind of emerged. Like he knew that, you know, this war thing, this war machine thing isn't good. And he was part of it too. Like 7 years he served in the British military. He came from that family. So yeah, like he knew very much what war was and how capitalists need war to keep going, and it fuels them so much. So don't go to the slaughter.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's a year before the Zimmerwald conference when those defeatist members of the social democracy, the European social democracy, meet and agree. And they don't actually agree to what Lenin's principles are. He says we have to get a document out there that says turn the imperial war into a civil war, full communism now. I know that's not what he says, but Connolly a year before that conference is held, totally anticipates Lenin's position, totally realizes this is the moment to strike against empire if you're ever going to do it. And he also anticipates almost everything Lenin writes in Imperialism, the Highest Age of Capitalism, having not read it. Now, they both had access to Hobson, is that the name of that author? Lenin used as a source, but he drew the exact same political conclusions. It's incredible.
I mean, he saw imperialism live, right? Like, he learned, he went to school, you know, in Imperialism University, in a sense, by serving with the British all those years. I mean, that's again, like, another, I mean, this guy actually exists. This guy, like, flowed through Irish history and, like, the Irish experience of the 20th, like, 19th and 20th century. And once again, cannot stress this man. This man rose from shit, like he was actually like in shit, and like his dad was too, and like he knew what like class was. Class is when your dad does the same job as you, and you haven't moved up in the world at all. This is at a time when liberalism promises you all these things. You know, like, how many centuries has been liberalism? Like, and liberalism is like promising to improve the lot of man and whatever. They know that this is bullshit, that like this system that's been devised like isn't working for us. And so it's so interesting to get a deeper dive into this. Anyways, I'm going to keep remarking the same thing over and over again, but let's keep going. So where are we in the grand timeline?
So on the question as to whether things are getting a bit more quiescent in this period, to come back to that for a second, an important thing to remember is kind of from around the 1880s, and you might be aware of this from your own literary studies, the nationalists or Gaelic revival is starting to get underway. And there's this broader and renewed interest in Gaelic games, Gaelic heritage, music, literature, poetry, dance, language. You know, Irish speaking is kind of coming back in urban areas and in particular social groups across the country. And Connolly is plugged into that. He was initially skeptical of things like the Irish language and, you know, kind of disregarded. But later on, he comes to realize, you know, the erosion of the Irish language is a consequence of British colonialism. And like another great socialist republican who came later, Martin O'Kine, he recognized that if we wanted to retain the history of the Irish people or the Irish language into the future, it would not happen under capitalism. It would only happen under socialism. I was reading a book just there before we came on about the history of the GAA, and how British police files suggest that they knew, or they thought, that Fenians had totally infiltrated the Gaelic Athletic Association, that they thought that this would be kind of a potential source for sedition. And sure enough, a lot of the most important figures, the people that Connolly worked most closely with, like Maud Gonne, Alice Milligan, Constance Markievicz, who were all suffragettes, trade unionists, and Irish language activists, he had a huge amount of goodwill from working with them, and they all became important in the rising, which we can kind of get onto at the end.
This is interesting for also a kind of cultural decolonization, and it's like, even though it wasn't called that, like the return to the indigenous language, the return to traditions. It's an interesting kind of, I know, and it's not really qualify as that, but it's interesting to think in those terms. Because even to this day, the question of the Irish language is still pretty sensitive, right? Because you have to speak Irish to get like a government job, right? To be like a civil servant in Ireland, right? But a lot of the population doesn't speak it.
So not quite. No, there'd be a lot of civil servants who don't speak Irish in the civil service. They're...
Oh, really? Oh.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not actually familiar with the guidelines. I think for primary school teaching, that used to be the case. Yeah, it's. I was just listening to a podcast there on the Gael Talks, and this might be slightly off topic, but during the COVID pandemic, you have these sections primarily along the West Coast where kind of the last native speakers are. With the pandemic... Okay, so it's a subject in Irish schools, right? But the irony of it is that you come out of school after 12 years not being able to speak a sentence, because they do this really old-fashioned grammatical approach rather than getting the emphasis on speaking it in kind of everyday life. And, you know, as I would advocate for it, going down there and becoming fluent in a couple of weeks, which you do if you immerse yourself in that environment. But without the sources of income of kids going down there for the summer to learn Irish, these places are becoming even more economically deprived than they were already. a lot of tourists are going down there, a lot of work from homers because of the lockdowns, and they're, you know, nicer big houses down in a rural environment. And they're all English speakers. They don't want to learn Irish. Irish speakers are getting, you know, are losing work. They're becoming unemployed, so they have to go into the cities to get work. So the basis that you used to have for this kind of barely clinging on thread that goes back thousands of years in terms of Cainteoirí Dúchasach native speakers is just being eroded even now in front of us by, you know, capitalism.
I mean, I know there's like attempts to, there's obviously like to attempts to save it, like, but the thing about the native losing native speakers is that, like, that's a fluency that you can't just simply make up. Like, you have to spend a lot of money training someone to attain something even close to native fluency. And yeah, it's just it's a very sad thought.
It is. And there was another kind of depressing study. A friend of mine describes himself as being more doomer about the future of the Irish language than climate change. There's this survey that pointed out that people from Dublin do occasionally try to, people from Dublin and people from Cork and Galway and other places do, without a native tradition, do try to learn Irish and are often quite successful because there are lessons available you can do. But, you know, it's a new linguistic community, so it comes with a whole different kinds of accents, a new kind of demotic usage that is often, you know, incorrect. And these people will go on the native Irish radio stations or television, and apparently native speakers will just turn it off because it's like nails on a chalkboard to them to hear, you know, people from the cities talking this pidgin, as far as they're concerned. So that, again, that's just fracturing the communities on which a new Irish language we build. We're getting off subject here pretty constantly.
That's fine.
Important part of the picture, I think.
Kilgallaghan on the Atlantic coast of County Mayo, Ireland. Here the oral tradition has lingered on. The last performer of epics the length of the Iliad died only 40 years ago, but there are still storytellers reciting tales of heroic deeds in heroic language. They resemble Homer in their style of speech, especially in the formulas or runs, whose repeat passages, like Homer's, are highly formalized. The storyteller we have come to hear cannot read or write and speaks only Gaelic. His name is John Henry. For the last 10 summers, John's repertoire has been recorded by Dr. Seamus O'Cahoyne of University College Dublin. John has not yet run out of stories.
For the dust sheets in the stable, moss on the satage. Hookshella shataka body in the stable, the Scotch and Swiss wash gift that he. Will sham boher boer, the sinshula vishayamu, vishachik swissa shalivi rudder, with salivi ni near shitik swisslish. The gradunagus genuine laetio. Will moss on the rimla cram, with such a commutivated la mihosu. Ach, we find a community of age, we had a hanging screw, a yard of a sage of Padoon. August, love with a pony, Charter 2 year, he took the pony. Tamagiri bought on long day, he took Morton, who's getting to long home.
So, yeah, well, I think we're at the turn. When are we?
So, I've been jumping around a lot just to give kind of a broad outline. So, I'll just, you know, and obviously I'll edit this out, but I've a dilemma for you, right? So, you know the way, and I'm sure if you've done the reading around Connolly, the Rising is sort of the main event, but the lockout is this other thing that happens first. And while the Rising is like 6 days, the lockout is like 6 months. So what do you want to do with that?
Whatever you want, like whatever's more interesting. I mean, we have no rules here.
Okay, all right, well then perfect. So In talking about kind of the Connolly's involvement with the broader nationalist movement, he gets involved with these people I've already mentioned, the suffragettes, around anti-monarchical protests. In 1897, it's the year of Queen Victoria's Diamond Jubilee, known in Ireland as the Famine Queen for obvious reasons. Connolly works with Maud Gonne, Irish Republican suffragette, in organizing protests, and they put together a lantern show put up black flags with anti-monarchical slogans and drive a wagon with a black coffin on the back with the words "the British Empire" written on it. The Crown forces block the path of the procession. Connolly throws the coffin into the Liffey, saying "to hell with the British Empire," and he spent the night in jail. The police batten protesters that are out on Parnell Square. They kill a woman, and every window on O'Connell Street, which is the main street through Dublin where a British flag is hanging, all the windows get smashed. And later on, he also undertakes a campaign of agitation against the British role in the Boer War, which breaks out towards the end of the 19th century. For those who don't know, it's the war between the two Boer republics in South Africa and the British Empire. So Connolly looks to organize kind of an anti-recruitment campaign in order to, because he sees this as an opportunity for an Irish rebellion to break out, and he was actually looking to the Boxer Rebellion as a model. The British are a bit more savvy than they were for the Diamond Jubilee in terms of celebrations. They send the Queen over in order to drum up patriotism, but they also pull in like rent-a-crowds, if you like. Loyalist companies like Guinness gave their workers the day off. Harland and Wolff, which up? Sorry, go on.
It's the birth of astroturfing.
Yeah, so Harland and Wolff astroturf by shipping their workers from the Belfast shipyards to Dublin, and they give out money, sweets, and food. But again, Connolly is leading the protest. Just kind of park that for a second. The I always remember thinking this isn't really great, right? That Connolly seems to be taking kind of the Dutch settlers' side in this, or their descendants anyway. Though I read recently that he described it as kind of two dogs fighting over a bone, neither of them owned, which is something. But he doesn't really frame it in the way that we would in terms of that understanding of settler colonialism. Do you know what I mean? Like, that's not coming through. The anti-recruitment campaign was very successful, and he managed to knock down recruitment to kind of a trickle. But yeah, he's better than a lot of the Second International, but he also seems to inherit a lot of their blind spots. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, this is one of the eternal stories, like again and again, of like the entire European socialist Marxist movement. I mean, let's fast forward what the position on Palestine and like the role of like communists and like the colonization of Palestine, like, is, you know, again, another example that like class solidarity can take the form of white supremacy, and that can become like a diverse European project, sort of pan-European project that brings together, you know, Polish and, you know, Brits and, you know, Spaniards and Portuguese, and towards a common goal, which is taking away land from other people. And so like it's an interesting, again, the Irish play this contradictory role inside of that.
They sat within a valley green. I sat me with my true love. My heart it strove me to between the old love and the new love. The old for heart, the new that made me think on island dearly. While soft the wind blew down the glen and shook the golden barley. 'Twas hard the awful words to frame, to break the ties that bound us, but harder still to bear the shame of foreign chains around us. And so I said, the mountain glen I'd seek at morning early, while soft the wind blew down the glen and shook the golden valley. was sad, I kissed away her tears, my fond arms round her flinging. The yeoman's shot burst on our ears, from out the wildwood ringing. The bullet pierced my true love's side in life's young spring so airy, and on my breast in blood she died, while soft wind shook the valley. But blood for blood, without remorse, I've taken a dullard's hollow and laid my true love's clay pole corpse where I full soon must follow. As round her grave I wander drear, noon night and morning airy, with breaking heart, whene'er I hear the wind that shakes the valley. The wind shakes the valley.